This is Audible.
Audible Inc. presents The Art of Strategy, a game theorist's guide to success in business and life. Written by Avinash K. Dixit and Barry J. Nailbuff. Narrated by Matthew Dudley. Visual aids found in the print edition of this book are available to you as a downloadable PDF. To access this file, please click on the link on the product page where you purchased this title. Thank you. Preface. We didn't set out to write a new book. The plan was simply to revise our 1991 book, Thinking Strategically. But it didn't quite turn out that way. One model for writing a revision comes from Borges' character Pierre Menard, who decides to rewrite Cervantes' Don Quixote. After great effort, Menard's revision ends up being word for word identical to the original. However, 300 years of history and literature have passed since Quixote, including Quixote himself. Although Menard's words are the same, his meaning is now entirely different. Alas, our original text wasn't Don Quixote, and so the revision did require changing a few words. In fact, most of the book is entirely new. There are new applications, new developments in the theory, and a new perspective. So much is new that we decided a new title was called for as well. Although the words are new, our meaning remains the same. We intend to change the way you see the world, to help you think strategically by introducing the concepts and logic of game theory. Like Menard, we have a new perspective. When we wrote Thinking Strategically, we were younger, and the zeitgeist was one of self-centered competition. We have since come to the full realization of the important part that cooperation plays in strategic situations, and how good strategy must appropriately mix competition and cooperation. Pursuing this line led one of us to write a book on this idea. See Adam Brandenberger and Barry J. Nailbuff, Co-opetition, New York, Doubleday, 1996. We started the original preface with, "Strategic thinking is the art of outdoing an adversary, knowing that the adversary is trying to do the same to you." To this we now add, "It is also the art of finding ways to cooperate, even when others are motivated by self-interest, not benevolence. It is the art of convincing others, and even yourself, to do what you say. It is the art of interpreting and revealing information. It is the art of putting yourself in others' shoes so as to predict and influence what they will do." We like to think that the art of strategy includes this older, wiser perspective. But there is also continuity. Even though we offer more real-life stories, our purpose remains to help you develop your own ways of thinking about the strategic situations you will face. This is not an airport book offering, 7 Steps for Sure Strategic Success. The situations you face will be so diverse that you will succeed better by knowing some general principles and adapting them to the strategic games you are playing. Businessmen and corporations must develop good competitive strategies to survive and find cooperative opportunities to grow the pie. Politicians have to devise campaign strategies to get elected and legislative strategies to implement their visions. Football coaches plan strategies for players to execute on the field. Parents trying to elicit good behavior from children must become amateur strategists. The children are pros. Good strategic thinking in such numerous diverse contexts remains an art. But its foundations consist of some simple basic principles, an emerging science of strategy, namely game theory. Our premise is that readers from a variety of backgrounds and occupations can become better strategists if they know these principles. Some people question how we can apply logic and science to a world where people act irrationally. It turns out that there is often method to the madness. Indeed, some of the most exciting new insights have come from recent advances in behavioral game theory, which incorporates human psychology and biases into the mix and thus adds a social element to the theory. As a result, game theory now does a much better job dealing with people as they are, rather than as we might like them to be. We incorporate these insights into our discussions. While game theory is a relatively young science, just over 70 years old, it has already provided many useful insights for practical strategists. But, like all sciences, it has become shrouded in jargon and mathematics. These are essential research tools, but they prevent all but the specialists from understanding the basic ideas. Our main motive for writing Thinking Strategically was the belief that game theory is too interesting and important to leave to the academic journals. The insights prove useful in many endeavors, business, politics, sports, and everyday social interactions. Thus, we translated the important insights back into English and replaced theoretical arguments with illustrative examples and case studies. We are delighted to find our view becoming mainstream. Game theory courses are some of the most popular electives at Princeton and Yale, and most other schools where they are offered. Game theory permeates strategy courses in MBA programs, and a Google search for game theory produces more than 6 million pages. You'll find game theory in newspaper stories, op-eds, and public policy debates. Of course, much of the credit for these developments belongs to others, to the Economics Nobel Prize Committee, which has awarded 2 prizes in game theory in 1994, to John Harsanyi, John Nash, and Reinhard Selten, and in 2005, to Robert Aumann and Thomas Schelling, to Sylvia Nasser, who wrote A Beautiful Mind, the best-selling biography of John Nash, to those who made the award-winning movie of the same name, and to all those who have written books popularizing the subject. We might even share a bit of the credit. Since publication, Thinking Strategically has sold 250,000 copies. It has been translated into numerous languages, and the Japanese and Hebrew translations have been bestsellers. We owe a special debt to Tom Schelling. His writings on nuclear strategies, particularly the strategy of conflict and arms and influence, are justly famous. In fact, Schelling pioneered a lot of game theory in the process of applying it to nuclear conflict. Michael Porter's competitive strategy, drawing on the lessons of game theory for business strategy, is equally important and influential. An annotated guide to the works of Schelling, Porter, and many others is provided in our further reading section. In this book, we do not confine the ideas to any particular context. Instead, we offer a wide range of illustrations for each basic principle. Thus, readers from different backgrounds will all find something familiar here. They will also see how the same principles bear on strategies in less familiar circumstances. We hope this will give them a new perspective on many events in news as well as history. We also draw on the shared experience of our readers, with illustrations from, for example, literature, movies, and sports. Serious scientists may think this trivializes strategy, but we believe that familiar examples are an effective vehicle for conveying the important ideas. The idea of writing a book at a more popular level than that of a course text came from Hal Varian, now at Google and the University of California, Berkeley. He also gave us many useful ideas and comments on earlier drafts. Drake McFeely at W.W. Norton was an excellent, if exacting, editor for Thinking Strategically. He made extraordinary efforts to fashion our academic writing into a lively text. Many readers of Thinking Strategically gave us encouragement, advice, and criticism, all of which have helped us when writing The Art of Strategy. At the grave risk of omitting some, we must mention ones to whom we owe special thanks. Our co-authors on other related and unrelated book projects, Ian Ayers, Adam Brandenberger, Robert Pindick, David Riley, and Susan Skeith, generously gave us much useful input. Others whose influence continues in this new book include David Austin Smith, Alan Blinder, Peter Grant, Seth Masters, Benjamin Pollack, Carl Shapiro, Terry Vaughn, and Robert Willig. Jack Repchek at W.W. Norton has been a constantly supportive, understanding, and perceptive editor for The Art of Strategy. Our manuscript editors, Janet Byrne and Catherine Picciotta, were generous to our faults. Every time you don't find a mistake, you should thank them. We owe special thanks to Andrew St. George, book critic for the Financial Times. In choosing Thinking Strategically as a book he enjoyed reading most in the year 1991, he said, "It is a trip to the gym for the reasoning facilities." FT Weekend, December 7, 8, 1991. This gave us the idea of labeling some intriguing challenges we pose to the readers in this edition, Trips to the Gym. Finally, John Morgan of the University of California, Berkeley, gave us a powerful incentive with the threat: "If you don't write a revision, I will write a competing book." And after we saved him the trouble, he helped us out with many ideas and suggestions. Avanish Dixit, Barry J. Nailbuff, October 2007. Introduction. How should people behave in society? Our answer does not deal with ethics or etiquette, nor do we aim to compete with philosophers, preachers, or parents. Our theme, although less lofty, affects the lives of all of us just as much as do morality and manners. This book is about strategic behavior. All of us are strategists, whether we like it or not. It is better to be a good strategist than a bad one, and this book aims to help you improve your skills at discovering and using effective strategies. Work, even social life, is a constant stream of decisions. What career to follow, how to manage a business, whom to marry, how to bring up children, and whether to run for president are just some examples of such fateful choices. The common element in these situations is that you do not act in a vacuum. Instead, you are surrounded by active decision makers whose choices interact with yours. This interaction has an important effect on your thinking and actions. To illustrate the point, think of the difference between the decisions of a lumberjack and those of a general. When the lumberjack decides how to chop wood, he does not expect the wood to fight back. His environment is neutral. But when the general tries to cut down the enemy's army, he must anticipate and overcome resistance to his plans. Like the general, you must recognize that your business rivals, prospective spouse, and even your children are strategic. Their aims often conflict with yours, but they may well coincide. Your own choice must allow for the conflict and utilize the cooperation. This book aims to help you think strategically and then translate these thoughts into action. The branch of social science that studies strategic decision-making is called game theory. The games in this theory range from chess to child-rearing, from tennis to takeovers, and from advertising to arms control. As the Hungarian humorist George Mikes expressed it, "Many continentals think life is a game. The English think cricket is a game. We think both are right." Playing these games requires many different kinds of skills. Basic skills, such as shooting ability in basketball, knowledge of precedence in law, or a blank face in poker, are one kind. Strategic thinking is another. Strategic thinking starts with your basic skills and considers how best to use them. Knowing the law, you must decide the strategy for defending your client. Knowing how well your football team can pass or run, and how well the other team can defend against each choice, your decision as the coach is whether to pass or to run. Sometimes, as in the case of nuclear brinkmanship, strategic thinking also means knowing when not to play. The science of game theory is far from being complete, and much of strategic thinking remains an art. Our ultimate aim is to make you better practitioners of that art, but this requires a good foundation in some elementary concepts and methods of the science. Therefore, we mix the two approaches. Chapter 1 begins with examples of the art, showing how strategic issues arise in a variety of decisions. We point out some effective strategies, some less effective ones, and even some downright bad ones that were used by players in these real-life games. These examples begin to suggest a conceptual framework. In the next set of chapters, 2-4, we build this basis for the science using examples, each of which is designed to bring out one principle. Then we turn our attention to more specific concepts and strategies for dealing with particular situations, how to mix moves when any systematic action can be exploited by the other player, how to change a game to your advantage, and how to manipulate information in strategic interaction. Finally, we take up several broad classes of strategic situations: bargaining, auctions, voting, and the design of incentives, where you can see these principles and strategies in action. Science and art, by their very nature, differ in that science can be learned in a systematic and logical way, whereas expertise in art has to be acquired by example, experience, and practice. Our exposition of the basic science generates some principles and broad rules. For example, the idea and method of backward reasoning that is developed in Chapter 2, and the concept of Nash equilibrium in Chapter 4. On the other hand, the art of strategy, in all the varied situations where you may need it, requires you to do more work. Each such situation will have some unique features that you must take into account and combine with the general principles of the science. The only way to improve your skill at this art is the inductive way, by seeing how it has been done before in similar situations. That is exactly how we aim to improve your strategic IQ, by giving numerous examples, including a case study, in each chapter and in a collection of case studies in the final chapter. The examples range from the familiar, trivial, or amusing, usually drawn from literature, sports, or movies, to the frightening nuclear confrontation. The former are merely a nice and palatable vehicle for the game-theoretic ideas. As to the latter, at one point in time, many readers would have thought the subject of nuclear war too horrible to permit rational analysis. But with the Cold War now long over, we hope that the game-theoretic aspects of the arms race and the Cuban Missile Crisis can be examined for their strategic logic with some detachment from their emotional content. The case studies are similar to ones you might come across in a business school class. Each case sets out a particular set of circumstances and invites you to apply the principles discussed in that chapter to find the right strategy for that situation. Some cases are open-ended, but that is also a feature of life. At times, there is no clearly correct solution, only imperfect ways to cope with the problem. A serious effort to think each case through before reading our discussion is a better way to understand the ideas than any amount of reading of the text alone. For more practice, the final chapter is a collection of cases in roughly increasing order of difficulty. By the end of the book, we hope that you will emerge a more effective manager, negotiator, athlete, politician, or parent. We warn you that some of the strategies that are good for achieving these goals may not earn you the love of your rivals. If you want to be fair, tell them about our book. Part 1. Chapter 1. 10 Tales of Strategy. We begin with 10 tales of strategy from different aspects of life and offer preliminary thoughts on how best to play. Many of you will have faced similar problems in everyday life and will have reached the correct solution after some thought or trial and error. For others, some of the answers may be surprising, but surprise is not the primary purpose of the examples. Our aim is to show that such situations are pervasive, that they amount to a coherent set of questions, and that methodical thinking about them is likely to be fruitful. In later chapters, we develop these systems of thought into prescriptions for effective strategy. Think of these tales as a taste of dessert before the main course. They are designed to whet your appetite, not fill you up. Number 1. Pick a number. Believe it or not, we are going to ask you to play a game against us. We've picked a number between 1 and 100, and your goal is to guess the number. If you guess correctly on the first try, we'll pay you $100. Actually, we aren't really going to pay you $100. It would be rather costly for us, especially since we want to give you some help along the way. But as you play the game, we'd like you to imagine that we really are going to give you money, and we'll play the same way. The chance of getting the number right on the first shot is quite low, only 1 in 100. So to improve your chances, we'll give you 5 guesses, and after each wrong guess, we'll also tell you if you are too high or too low. Of course, there's a bigger reward for getting the right answer quickly. If you guess correctly on the second try, you'll get $80. On the third try, the payment is down to $60, then $40 for the fourth guess, and $20 if you get the number on the fifth try. If it takes more than 5 guesses, the game is over and you get nothing. Are you ready to play? We are too. If you are wondering how to play a game with a book, it is a bit of a challenge, but not impossible. You can go to the www.artofstrategy.net website and play the game interactively. Or we can anticipate how you might be playing the game and respond accordingly. Is your first guess 50? That's the most common first guess, and alas for you, it's too high. Might your second guess be 25? Following 50, that is what most folks do. Sorry, that's too low. The next step for many is 37. We're afraid that 37 is too low. What about 42? Too low again. Let's pause, take a step back, and analyze the situation. This is your fifth guess coming up, and your last chance to take our money. You know the number is above 42 and less than 50. There are 7 options, 43, 44, 45, 46, 47, 48, and 49. Which of those 7 do you think it will be? So far, you have been guessing in a way that divides the interval into 2 equal parts and picking the midpoint. This is the ideal strategy in a game where the number has been chosen at random. The technical term for this search strategy is minimizing the entropy. You are getting the most information possible from each guess, and therefore will converge to the number as quickly as possible. Indeed, Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer is said to have used this game as a job interview question. For Ballmer, the correct answer was 50, 25, 37, 42. He was interested in seeing if the candidate approached the search problem in the most logical and efficient manner. Our answer is a bit different. In Ballmer's problem, the number was picked at random, and so the engineer's strategy of divide the set in two and conquer was just right. Getting the most information from each guess minimizes the expected number of guesses and therefore leads you to get the most money. In our case, however, the number was not picked at random. Remember that we said that we were playing this game as if we actually had to pay you the money. Well, no one is reimbursing us for money that, hypothetically, we would have to pay you. And as much as we like you for having bought our book, we like ourselves even more. We'd rather keep the money than give it to you. So we deliberately picked a number that would be hard for you to find. Think about it for a moment. Would it have made any sense for us to have picked 50 as the number? That would have cost us a fortune. The key lesson of game theory is to put yourself in the other player's shoes. We put ourselves in your shoes and anticipated that you would guess 50, then 25, then 37, then 42. Understanding how you would play the game allowed us to greatly decrease the chance that you would guess our number and thus reduce how much we'd have to pay out. In explaining all of this to you before the game is over, we've given you a big hint. So now that you understand the real game you are playing, you've got one last guess. For $20, what number do you pick? 49? Congratulations. To us, not you. You've fallen right into our trap again. The number we picked was 48. Indeed, the whole speech about picking a number that was hard to find according to the split the interval rule was further designed to mislead you. We wanted you to pick 49 so that our choice of 48 would remain safe. Remember, our objective is not to give you money. To beat us at that game, you had to be one step ahead of us. You would have had to think, they want us to pick 49, so I'm going to pick 48. Of course, if we had thought you would have been so clever, then we would have picked 47, or even 49. The larger point of this game is not that we are selfish professors or cunning tricksters. Rather, the point is to illustrate as cleanly as possible what makes something a game. You have to take into account the objectives and strategies of the other players. When guessing a number picked at random, the number isn't trying to hide. You can take the engineer's mindset and divide the interval in two and do the best possible. But if you are playing a game, then you have to consider how the other player will be acting and how those decisions will influence your strategy. Number two, winning by losing. We admit it. We watched Survivor. We would never have made it on the island. If we hadn't starved first, the others would surely have voted us off for being eggheads. For us, the challenge was trying to predict how the game would play out. We weren't surprised when the pudgy nudist, Richard Hatch, outwitted, outplayed, and outlasted his rivals to become the first champion of the CBS series and earn the $1 million prize. He was gifted in his ability to act strategically without appearing to be strategic. Hatch's most cunning ploy was in the last episode. The game was down to three players. Richard's two remaining rivals were 72-year-old retired Navy SEAL Rudy Bosch and 23-year-old river guide Kelly Wigglesworth. For their final challenge, the three of them had to stand on a pole with one hand on the immunity idol. The last one standing would go into the finals. And just as important, the winner would get to choose his or her opponent in the finals. Your first impression might be that this was just a physical endurance contest. Think again. All three players understood that Rudy was the most popular of the three. If Rudy made it to the finals, Rudy would likely win. Richard's best hope was to go against Kelly in the finals. There were two ways that could happen. One is that Kelly would win the pole standing competition and pick Richard. The other is that Richard would win and pick Kelly. Richard could count on Kelly picking him. She was also aware of Rudy's popularity. Her best hope of winning was to get to the finals against Richard. It would seem that if either Richard or Kelly won the final challenge, each would pick the other as his or her opponent. Hence, Richard should try to stay in the game, at least until Rudy had fallen off. The only problem is that Richard and Rudy had a long-standing alliance. If Richard won the challenge and didn't pick Rudy, that would have turned Rudy and all Rudy's friends against Richard, and this could have cost him the victory. One of the great twists of Survivor is that the ousted contestants vote to determine the final winner. One has to be very careful how one disposes of rivals. From Richard's perspective, the final challenge could go one of three ways. 1. Rudy wins, Rudy then picks Richard, but Rudy would be the likely victor. 2. Kelly wins, Kelly would be smart enough to know her best hope was to eliminate Rudy and go against Richard. 3. Richard wins. If he picks Rudy to go on, Rudy beats him in the finals. If he picks Kelly to go on, Kelly might beat him because Richard would lose the support of Rudy and his many friends. Comparing these options, Richard does best by losing. He wants Rudy eliminated, but it is better if Kelly does the dirty work for him. The smart money was on Kelly winning the challenge. She had won three of the previous four and as an outdoors guide was in the best shape of the three. As a bonus, throwing the game saved Richard the trouble of standing on a pole under a hot sun. Early in the competition, host Jeff Probst offered a slice of orange to anyone willing to call it quits. Richard stepped off the pole and took the orange. Throughout the book, you'll find these asides, which contain what we call a trip to the gym. These trips take a look at more advanced elements of the game that we glossed over. For example, Richard could have tried to wait and see who dropped out first. If Kelly fell early, Richard might have preferred to beat Rudy and choose Kelly than to let Rudy win and have to go against Rudy in the finals. He might also have been concerned that Kelly would be savvy enough to do the same calculation and drop out early. The next chapters will show you how to use a more systematic approach to solve a game. The end goal is to help change the way you approach strategic situations, recognizing that you won't always have time to analyze every possible option. After 4 hours and 11 minutes, Rudy fumbled when shifting his stance, let go of the immunity idol, and lost. Kelly picked Richard to go on to the finals. Rudy cast the swing vote in his favor, and Richard Hatch became the first Survivor champion. With the benefit of hindsight, it may all seem easy. What makes Richard's play so impressive is that he was able to anticipate all the different moves before they happened. In Chapter 2, we'll provide some tools to help you anticipate the way a game will play out and even give you a chance to have a go at another Survivor game. Number 3. The Hot Hand. Do athletes ever have a hot hand? Sometimes it seems that Yao Ming cannot miss a basket, or that Sachin Tendulkar cannot fail to score a century in cricket. Sports announcers see these long streaks of consecutive successes and proclaim that the athlete has a hot hand. Yet according to psychology professors Thomas Gilovich, Robert Vallone, and Amos Tversky, this is a misperception of reality. They point out that if you flip a coin long enough, you will find some very long series of consecutive heads. The psychologists suspect that sports commentators, short on insightful things to say, are just finding patterns at what amounts to a long series of coin tosses over a long playing season. They propose a more rigorous test. In basketball, they look at all the instances of a player's baskets and observe the percentage of times that player's next shot is also a basket. A similar calculation is made for the shots immediately following misses. If a basket is more likely to follow a basket than to follow a miss, then there really is something to the theory of the hot hand. They conducted this test on the Philadelphia 76ers basketball team. The results contradicted the hot hand view. When a player made his last shot, he was less likely to make his next. When he missed his previous attempt, he was more likely to make his next. This was true even for Andrew Toney, a player with the reputation for being a streak shooter. Does this mean we should be talking of the stroboscopic hand, like the strobe light that alternates between on and off? Game theory suggests a different interpretation. While the statistical evidence denies the presence of streak shooting, it does not refute the possibility that a hot player might warm up the game in some other way. The difference between streak shooting and a hot hand arises because of the interaction between the offensive and defensive strategies. Suppose Andrew Toney does have a truly hot hand. Surely the other side would start to crowd him. This could easily lower his shooting percentage. That is not all. When the defense focuses on Toney, one of his teammates is left unguarded and is more likely to shoot successfully. In other words, Toney's hot hand leads to an improvement in the 76ers' team performance, although there may be a deterioration in Toney's individual performance. Thus, we might test for hot hands by looking for streaks in team success. Similar phenomena are observed in many other team sports. A brilliant running back on a football team improves the team's passing game and a great receiver helps the running game, as the opposition is forced to allocate more of its defensive resources to guard the stars. In the 1986 Soccer World Cup final, Argentine star Diego Maradona did not score a goal, But his passes through a ring of West German defenders led to two Argentine goals. The value of a star cannot be assessed by looking only at his scoring performance. His contribution to his teammates' performance is crucial, and assist statistics help measure this contribution. In ice hockey, assists and goals are given equal weight for ranking individual performance. A player may even assist himself when one hot hand warms up the other. The Cleveland Cavaliers star, LeBron James, eats and writes with his left hand but prefers shooting with his right, though his left hand is still better than most. The defense knows that LeBron is right-handed, so they concentrate on defending against right-handed shots. But they do not do so exclusively, since LeBron's left-handed shots are too effective to be left unguarded. What happens when LeBron spends his off-season working to improve his left-handed shooting? The defense responds by spending more time covering his left-handed shots. The result is that this frees his right hand more often. A better left-handed shot results in a more effective right-handed shot. In this case, not only does the left hand know what the right hand is doing, it's helping it out. Going one step further, in Chapter 5, we show that when the left hand is stronger, it may even be used less often. Many of you will have experienced this seemingly strange phenomenon when playing tennis. If your backhand is much weaker than your forehand, your opponents will learn to play to your backhand. Eventually, as a result of all this backhand practice, your backhand will improve. As your two strokes become more equal, opponents can no longer exploit your weak backhand. They will play more evenly between forehand and backhand. You get to use your better forehand more often. This could be the real advantage of improving your backhand. Number 4. To lead or not to lead. After the first four races in the 1983 America's Cup Finals, Dennis Connors' Liberty led 3-1 in a best-of-seven series. On the morning of the fifth race, cases of champagne had been delivered to Liberty's dock, and on their spectator yacht, the wives of the crew were wearing red, white, and blue tops and shorts in anticipation of having their picture taken after their husbands had prolonged the United States winning streak to 132 years. It was not to be. At the start, Liberty got off to a 37-second lead when Australia 2 jumped the gun and had to recross the starting line. The Australian skipper, John Bertrand, tried to catch up by sailing way over to the left of the course in the hopes of catching a wind shift. Dennis Connor chose to keep Liberty on the right-hand side of the course. Bertrand's gamble paid off. The wind shifted 5 degrees in Australia 2's favor, and she won the race by 1 minute and 47 seconds. Connor was criticized for his strategic failure to follow Australia 2's path. Two races later, Australia 2 won the series. Sailboat racing offers the chance to observe an interesting reversal of a follow-the-leader strategy. The leading sailboat usually copies the strategy of the trailing boat. When the follower tacks, so does the leader. The leader imitates the follower even when the follower is clearly pursuing a poor strategy. Why? Because in sailboat racing, unlike ballroom dancing, close doesn't count. Only winning matters. If you have the lead, the surest way to stay ahead is to play monkey see, monkey do. This strategy no longer applies once there are more than two competitors. Even with three boats, if one boat tacks right and the other tacks left, the leader has to choose which, if either, to follow. Stock market analysts and economic forecasters are not immune to this copycat strategy. The leading forecasters have an incentive to follow the pack and produce predictions similar to everyone else's. This way, people are unlikely to change their perception of these forecasters' abilities. On the other hand, newcomers take the risky strategies. They tend to predict boom or doom. Usually, they are wrong and are never heard of again. But now and again, they are proven correct and move to the ranks of the famous. Industrial and technological competitions offer further evidence. In the personal computer market, Dell is less known for its innovation than for its ability to bring standardized technology to the mass market. more new ideas have come from Apple, Sun, and other startup companies. Risky innovations are their best and perhaps only chance of gaining market share. This is true not just of high technology goods. Procter & Gamble, the Dell of diapers, followed Kimberly-Clark's innovation of resealable diaper tape and recaptured its commanding market position. There are two ways to move second. You can imitate as soon as the other has revealed his approach, as in sailboat racing, or wait longer until the success or failure of the approach is known, as in computers. The longer wait is more advantageous in business because, unlike in sports, the competition is usually not winner-take-all. As a result, market leaders will not follow the upstarts unless they also believe in the merits of their course. Number 5. Here I Stand. When the Catholic Church demanded that Martin Luther repudiate his attack on the authority of popes and councils, he refused to recant. "I will not recant anything, for to go against conscience is neither right nor safe." Nor would he compromise. "Here I stand, I cannot do otherwise." Luther's intransigence was based on the divinity of his positions. When defining what was right, there was no room for compromise. His firmness had profound long-term consequences. His attacks led to the Protestant Reformation and substantially altered the medieval Catholic Church. Similarly, Charles de Gaulle used the power of intransigence to become a powerful player in the arena of international relations. As his biographer, Don Cook, expressed it, "De Gaulle could create power for himself with nothing but his own rectitude, intelligence, personality, and sense of destiny." But above all, his was the power of intransigence. During the Second World War, as the self-proclaimed leader in exile of a defeated and occupied nation, he held his own in negotiations with Roosevelt and Churchill. In the 1960s, his presidential non swung several decisions France's way in the European Economic Community, EEC. In what way did his intransigence give him power in bargaining? When de Gaulle took a truly irrevocable position, the other parties in the negotiation were left with just two options: to take it or to leave it. For example, he single-handedly kept England out of the European Economic Community, once in 1963 and again in 1968. The other countries were forced either to accept de Gaulle's veto or to break up the EEC. De Gaulle judged his position carefully to ensure that it would be accepted. But that often left the larger and unfair division of the spoils to France. De Gaulle's intransigence denied the other party an opportunity to come back with a counteroffer that was acceptable. In practice, this is easier said than done, for two kinds of reasons. The first kind stems from the fact that bargaining usually involves considerations other than the pie on today's table. The perception that you have been excessively greedy may make others less willing to negotiate with you in the future. Or, next time, they may be more firm bargainers as they try to recapture some of their perceived losses. On a personal level, an unfair win may spoil business relations or even personal relations. Indeed, biographer David Schoenbrunn faulted de Gaulle's chauvinism. "In human relations, those who do not love are rarely loved. Those who will not be friends end up by having none. De Gaulle's rejection of friendship thus hurt France." A compromise in the short term may prove a better strategy over the long haul. The second kind of problem lies in achieving the necessary degree of intransigence. Luther and de Gaulle achieved this through their personalities, but this entails a cost. An inflexible personality is not something you can just turn on and off. Although being inflexible can sometimes wear down an opponent and force him to make concessions, it can equally well allow small losses to grow into major disasters. Ferdinand de Lesseps was a mildly competent engineer with extraordinary vision and determination. He is famous for building the Suez Canal in what seemed almost impossible conditions. He did not recognize the impossible and thereby accomplished it. Later, he tried using the same technique to build the Panama Canal. It ended in disaster. The Suez Canal is a sea-level passage. The digging was relatively easy since the land was already low-lying and desert. Panama involved much higher elevations, lakes along the way, and dense jungle. Lesseps' attempt to dig down to sea level failed. Whereas the sands of the Nile yielded to his will, tropical malaria did not. The problem for de Lesseps was that his inflexible personality could not admit defeat even when the battle was lost. How can one achieve selective inflexibility? Although there is no ideal solution, there are various means by which commitment can be achieved and sustained. This is the topic for Chapter 7. Number 6. Thinning strategically. Cindy Nesson Schechter wanted to lose weight. She knew just what to do. Eat less and exercise more. She knew all about the food pyramid and the hidden calories in soft drinks. Still, nothing had worked. She had gained 40 pounds with the birth of her second child, and it just wasn't coming off. That's why she accepted ABC's offer to help her lose weight. On December 9th, 2005, she came into a photographer's studio on Manhattan's West Side, where she found herself changing into a bikini. She hadn't worn a bikini since she was 9, and this wasn't the time to start again. The setup felt like backstage at the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue shoot. There were lights and cameras everywhere, and all she had on was a tiny lime green bikini. The producers had thoughtfully placed a hidden space heater to keep her warm. Snap, smile, snap, smile. What in the world was she thinking? Snap. If things worked out as she hoped, no one would ever see these pictures. The deal she made with ABC Primetime was that they would destroy the pictures if she lost 15 pounds over the next 2 months. They wouldn't help her in any way. No coach, no trainer, no special diets. She already knew what she had to do. All she needed was some extra motivation and a reason to start today rather than tomorrow. Now she had that extra motivation. If she didn't lose the promised weight, ABC would show the photos and the videos on primetime television. She had already signed the release giving them permission. 15 pounds in 2 months was a safe amount to lose, but it wouldn't be a cakewalk. There was a series of holiday parties and Christmas dinners. She couldn't risk waiting until the new year. She had to start now. Cindy knew all about the dangers of being overweight, the increased risk of diabetes, heart attack, and death. And yet, that wasn't enough to scare her into action. What she feared more than anything was the possibility that her ex-boyfriend would see her hanging out of a bikini on national TV. And there was little doubt that he would watch the show. Her best friend was going to tell him if she failed. Lori Edwards didn't like the way she looked or how she felt. It didn't help that she worked part-time tending bar, surrounded by hot 20-somethings. She had tried Weight Watchers, South Beach, Slim Fast, you name it. She was headed in the wrong direction and needed something to help her change course. When she told her girlfriends about the show, they thought it was the stupidest thing she'd ever done. The cameras captured that, "What am I doing?" look on her face and a lot more. Ray needed to lose weight too. He was a newlywed in his 20s, but looked closer to 40. As he walked the red carpet in his racing swimsuit, it wasn't a pretty picture. Click, smile, click. He wasn't taking any chances. His wife wanted him to lose weight and was willing to help. She offered to diet with him. Then she took the plunge. She changed into a bikini too. She wasn't as overweight as Ray, but she wasn't bikini ready either. Her deal was different from Cindy's. She didn't have to weigh in. She didn't even have to lose weight. The pictures of her in a bikini would only be shown if Ray didn't lose the weight. For Ray, the stakes had been raised even higher. He was either going to lose the weight or his wife. Altogether, four women and one couple bared their souls and much more in front of the cameras. What were they doing? They weren't exhibitionists. the ABC producers had carefully screened them out. None of the five wanted to see these photos appear on TV, and none of them expected they ever would. They were playing a game against their future selves. Today's self wants the future self to diet and exercise. The future self wants the ice cream and the television. Most of the time, the future self wins because it gets to move last. The trick is to change the incentives for the future self so as to change its behavior. In Greek mythology, Odysseus wanted to hear the sirens' songs. He knew that if he allowed his future self to listen to their song, the future self would sail his ship into the rocks. So he tied his hands, literally. He had his crew bind his hands to the mast while plugging their own ears. In dieting, this is known as the empty fridge strategy. Cindy, Lori, and Ray went one step further. They put themselves in a bind that only dieting would get them out of. You might think that having more options is always a good thing, but thinking strategically, you can often do better by cutting off options. Thomas Schelling describes how the Athenian general Xenophon fought with his back against an impassable ravine. He purposefully set himself up so that his soldiers had no option of retreat. Backs stiffened, they won. Similarly, Cortez scuttled his ships upon arrival in Mexico. This decision was made with the support of his troops. Vastly outnumbered, his 600 soldiers decided that they would either defeat the Aztecs or perish trying. The Aztecs could retreat inland, but for Cortez's soldiers, there was no possibility of desertion or retreat. By making defeat worse, Cortez increased his chance of victory and indeed conquered. Cortez was also helped by the Aztecs' misconception that he was Quetzalcoatl, a fair-skinned god. What worked for Cortez and Xenophon worked for Cindy, Lori, and Ray. 2 months later, just in time for Valentine's Day, Cindy had lost 17 pounds. Ray was down 22 pounds and 2 belt loops. While the threat was the motivator to get them started, once they got going, they were doing it for themselves. Lori lost the required 15 pounds in the first month. She kept on going and lost another 13 in month 2. Lori's 28 pounds translated into 2 dress sizes and over 14% of her body weight. Her friends no longer think the ABC show was a stupid idea. At this point, you shouldn't be surprised to know that one of us was behind the show's design. Perhaps we should have called this book Thinning Strategically and sold many more copies. Alas, not. And we return to study these types of strategic moves in Chapter 6. Number 7. Buffett's Dilemma. In an op-ed promoting campaign finance reform, the Oracle of Omaha, Warren Buffett, proposed raising the limit on individual contributions from $1,000 to $5,000 and banning all other contributions. No corporate money, no union money, no soft money. It sounds great, except that it would never pass. Campaign finance reform is so hard to pass because the incumbent legislators who have to approve it are the ones who have the most to lose. Their advantage in fundraising is what gives them job security. Between 1992 and 2000, the majority of incumbent congressmen in a challenged race had at least 84% of the total campaign spending backing them up. Of those races, only one, out of 905, resulted in a loss for the incumbent. That one incumbent, Dan Rostenkowski, was under indictment on 17 counts of extortion, obstruction of justice, and misuse of funds. How do you get people to do something that is against their interest? Put them in what is known as the prisoner's dilemma. According to Buffett, well, just suppose some eccentric billionaire, not me, made the following offer. If the bill was defeated, this person, the EB, would donate $1 billion in an allowable manner, soft money makes all possible, to the political party that had delivered the most votes to getting it passed. Given this diabolical application of game theory, the bill would sail through Congress and thus cost our EB nothing, establishing him as not so eccentric after all. Consider your options as a Democratic legislator. If you think that the Republicans will support the bill, and you work to defeat it, then if you are successful, you will have delivered $1 billion to the Republicans, thereby handing them the resources to dominate for the next decade. Thus, there is no gain in opposing the bill if the Republicans are supporting it. Now, if the Republicans are against it and you support it, then you have the chance of making $1 billion. Thus, whatever the Republicans do, the Democrats should support the bill. Of course, the same logic applies to the Republicans. They should support the bill no matter what the Democrats do. In the end, both parties support the bill, and our billionaire gets his proposal for free. As a bonus, Buffett notes that the very effectiveness of his plan would highlight the absurdity of claims that money doesn't influence congressional votes. This situation is called a prisoner's dilemma because both sides are led to take an action that is against their mutual interest. The active players in the game are the losers, but outsiders can benefit. While incumbent politicians might be unhappy with campaign finance reform, the rest of us would be better off. In the classic version of the prisoner's dilemma, the police are separately interrogating two suspects. Each is given an incentive to be the first to confess and a much harsher sentence if he holds out while the other confesses. Thus, each finds it advantageous to confess, though they would both do better if each kept quiet. Truman Capote's In Cold Blood provides a vivid illustration. Richard Dick Hickok and Perry Edward Smith have been arrested for the senseless murder of the Clutter family. While there were no witnesses to the crime, a jailhouse snitch had given their names to the police. During the interrogation, the police play one against the other. Capote takes us into Perry's mind. That it was just another way of getting under his skin, like that phony business about a witness, a living witness, there couldn't be. Or did they mean, if only he could talk to Dick, but he and Dick were being kept apart. Dick was locked in a cell on another floor. And Dick? Presumably, they'd pull the same stunt on him. Dick was smart, a convincing performer, but his guts were unreliable. He panicked too easily. And before you left that house, you killed all the people in it. It wouldn't amaze him if every old grad in Kansas had heard that line. They must have questioned hundreds of men and no doubt accused dozens. He and Dick were merely two more. And Dick, awake in a cell on the floor below, was, he later recalled, equally eager to converse with Perry, find out what the punk had told them. Eventually, Dick confessed, and then Perry. That's the nature of the game. The problem of collective action is a variant of the prisoner's dilemma, albeit one with many more than two prisoners. In the children's story about Belling the cat, the mice decide that life would be much safer if the cat were stuck with a bell around its neck. The problem is, who will risk his life to bell the cat? This is a problem for both mice and men. How can unpopular tyrants control large populations for long periods? Why can a lone bully terrorize a schoolyard? In both cases, a simultaneous move by the masses stands a very good chance of success. But the communication and coordination required for such action is difficult, and the oppressors, knowing the power of the masses, take special steps to keep it difficult. When the people must act individually and hope that the momentum will build up, the question arises, who is going to be the first? Such a leader will pay a high cost, a broken nose, or possibly his life. His reward may be posthumous glory or gratitude. There are people who are moved by considerations of duty or honor, but most find the costs exceed the benefits. Khrushchev first denounced Stalin's purges at the Soviet Communist Party's 20th Congress. After his dramatic speech, someone in the audience shouted out, asking what Khrushchev had been doing at the time. Khrushchev responded by asking the questioner to please stand up and identify himself. The audience remained silent. Khrushchev replied, "That is what I did, too."